Okay, so welcome back, everyone. Hope you had a good cup of tea. And let's begin by the meditation. And as I said before, it's the, you probably already have a practice, so you probably already know, but it is just the, I think, the most basic, fundamental, profound act of kindness we can give to ourselves along the way, is to develop this sense of, or this skill in settling ourselves, finding a peaceful space, inner space, where we can connect with the best of who we are, which is good, actually. The best of who we are is very good. And rest and give our poor, busy, busy minds a rest. So we'll go back again to focusing on our body, and go through to focusing on our breath. I say, unless you have your own practice, which by all means carry on doing that. And we'll do that for about 10 minutes together. Okay, so mute if you wish. Turn your camera off if you wish, or just stay as you are, that's fine. And we focus on the posture in order to be supportive. Remembering the qualities that we desire are stability, stillness, peace, and also alertness, if we can. Stability and peace, stillness come first. And it's good not to be trying too hard, to relax into it. Just do the best you can and be content with that. And focus on your body. And in your own time, gradually bring the focus of your attention through to the simple sensations of breathing, your normal rhythms of breathing. Just be interested in what happens with each in-breath and each out-breath. No judging, just accepting. And enjoy. Enjoy your meditation. if So if you find you're drifting into sleepiness, it may just be that you're very tired. Or it may be that if you adjust your posture a little by holding your spine upright and then relaxing, that may help. Being upright and opening your chest slightly can help combat doziness, sleepiness. If, on the other hand, your mind is busy racing, again, a slight adjustment in posture might help. If you just lower the head slightly, sort of tilt it very slightly forward, as if you're gazing further down on the ground. And again, check that you're relaxed. If thoughts and distractions keep arising in your mind, as often happens, then it's not that we need perfection. We're looking for perfection. Try to just view them as passing phenomena, like small fluffy white clouds passing by. I often use the image of meditation as being in a restaurant with a friend. Engage in conversation. There's all sorts of background noise going on. But if we're really interested in the friend's conversation, then that's just peripheral. It doesn't matter. It doesn't take our attention. We're vaguely aware. But our main focus, our main awareness is on the conversation. So in the same way, our main focus is on our breath, and other stuff is generally peripheral, background noise, doesn't matter. Gradually it will subside, or it won't. So long as some part of your attention is on the breath, that's fine. And when you lose it completely and realize you've been off on in a daydream or a fantasy or memory, then kindly and gently begin again. Bring your attention, your awareness back to the breath as often as it takes. gently and the meditation. Okay, so I looked up, I mentioned briefly in the last session an article by that I'd read by Mathieu Ricard, which is called, which I looked up again in the tea break, From Empathy to Compassion in a Neuroscience Laboratory, which I haven't put on the resources. You know, there are some resources online. I don't know if anybody's had a chance to look at them yet. Or wanted to, but anyway, this one isn't there, unfortunately, because I only reread it yesterday. But maybe if anyone is interested in looking at it further, it's only about 6-7 pages, I can find some way of passing it on to you, either through Land of Joy or through my email. But there's one bit that I wanted to, where he says, it goes through those the sort of the three dimensions or the difference between empathy and compassion. And also he brings up the connection with love, altruistic love, which we define here as the wish for others to be happy, plain and simple, not anything more than that, not needing anything back from them, but the wish for others and for ourselves to be happy. And have the causes of happiness. So he talks about the three dimensions of love, empathy, and compassion. So I'll just read that bit if that's okay. So these three dimensions, love of the other, empathy, which is resonance with another's suffering, a bit like a string of an instrument, and compassion are naturally linked. When altruistic love encounters suffering, it manifests as compassion. This transformation is triggered by empathy, which alerts us to the fact that the other is suffering. So that's that when we talk about the three aspects of compassion as well, it's that noticing, empathy is caring, and then the compassion is wishing to do something. So he says, which I really love this sentence, one may say that when altruistic love passes through the prism of empathy, it becomes compassion. Which I think kind of sums it up nicely. And then to bring us on to segue nicely into this next section, I found another quote in there. Here we go. He's quoting a psychologist, French psychologist, Christophe André, who says, we need the gentleness and strength of compassion. The more lucid we are about the world, the more we accept seeing it as it really is, the easier it is to accept that we cannot face all the suffering that is encountered in the course of our lives unless we have this strength and this gentleness. Shall I read that again? That's quite a lot in there, isn't it? It's quite nice. We need the gentleness and the strength of compassion. So there's two aspects there he describes. And this is the bit that I want to take further. The more lucid we are about the world, the more we accept seeing it as it really is, the easier it is to accept that we cannot face all the suffering that is encountered in the course of our lives unless we have this strength and this gentleness, unless we have compassion. Which brings us on to one of the next thing that I wanted to look at, really, which is he talks about being lucid, more lucid we are about the world. The basis of compassion, really, and the basis of the wisdom that is also linked very clearly with compassion, is being able to see things as they are. Being able to acknowledge and accept that suffering is part of life. There isn't anybody in the whole history of the world who hasn't undergone some kind of suffering in their life. There are greater and lesser degrees, clearly. But suffering, you know, even from the smallest, you know, pain of stubbing your toe to the terrible griefs that can engulf us, all of that is actually part of life. And actually, somebody, Anne, you've been at the teachings on Saturday mornings that I've attended, and the teacher there described suffering as, he said, there's many different ways of describing suffering, but basically it's anything we don't want, which I thought just kind of summed it up nicely. There are always going to be things that we don't want, greater or lesser. And I think maybe part of the difficulty with that can come with compassion is that, particularly in our culture perhaps now, we don't want to acknowledge suffering. We kind of think it's some kind of mistake, you know, that we've blown it somehow. We're suffering because of some individual mistake that we made. We're some kind of loser. It's our fault. And it's embarrassing, or it's something to be ashamed of, even sometimes people think. But actually, a very simple acknowledgement is there is nobody in the entire history of the world who has not undergone some kind of suffering. And so that lucidity in the face of life that Christoph André is suggesting, and which for those of you who are Buddhists will also recognize, is that, you know, that something becomes less frightening if we can confront it. It has less power over us if we can confront it to some kind of degree. And it can be, I'm not saying it always is, but it can be that our fear of suffering or our dislike of suffering or our not being confident that we can handle suffering, that can hold us back from compassion. So basically, if we can acknowledge that that it exists, that it's not a personal mistake, that there's no way to avoid it. Well, there are some sufferings can be avoided, but the fact of suffering, it exists, and it's universal. It exists for everybody. It's something actually that we share. And if we can begin to kind of come to terms with that, that fact, then that can move us along a bit. And this whole process, I want to say now in case I forget later, but this whole process of learning compassion, of cultivating greater compassion, is we take it in very small steps. It's a wonderful aspiration, but it takes courage, it takes wisdom, and it takes skill. And we're not always up to it. Basically, we can't always do it. So we take it in small steps, and we've talked in our regular meetings on a Wednesday down in Bath. This notion of stretch, that we if we set a direction that we want to travel in, we know that the steps are going to be small. We just stretch ourselves a little bit when we can. Sometimes we come back and kind of retrench, and sometimes we'll feel stretch a little bit more. And I often tell the story of a friend who, when I was grieving after my father died a long time ago now, but I was grieving quite badly and also wanting to help my mum, who I didn't have a particularly good relationship with at the time. And I said, you know, I don't know what to do. And he said to me, this friend said, well, just do the best you can, which was advice that other people had given me, which was helpful and kind, came from kindness. But what he said was different. He said, and then do a little bit more. And for me, that was a really fantastic piece of advice, and one that I've really followed, because he wasn't saying be perfect or do this or set this goal or whatever. He was just saying, do the best you can and try a little bit more. Just try. And a little bit more, I was having a go. I could try that sometimes, not always. Sometimes I could try a little bit more. And gradually, you know, it got better, it improved, our relationship improved. So we are, you know, I'm not going to set everybody up to kind of beat themselves up because they're not compassionate enough after a whole weekend studying it. It's a slow process and it's a difficult process, and it takes courage. But actually, from the maybe one of the conclusions that people often come to is that it also gives courage. So that as we can develop our compassion, it actually gives us great courage. It encourages us. So that's the first sign of those three aspects of compassion is to acknowledge suffering, the individual aspects and the fact of suffering. And I don't know quite why, but anyway, I just had the notion that I would like to try and involve some poetry in this course. So I'm going to read one poem now, which kind of encapsulates this a bit, I think. It's the poem's called Musée des Beaux-Arts by W.H. Auden. I don't know if you know it.
You want to up Len? Do you want to up one screen?
Oh yeah, please. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I'd forgotten it was there. And it's written about the story of. It's written by Auden after he looked at a painting at this museum. Of the story of Icarus. I don't know how familiar you are with the story of Icarus, but he and his father escaped it's a Greek myth. He and his father escaped from their island prison by fashioning wings out of wax and feathers. But Icarus, in his youthful enthusiasm, flew too close to the sun, and the wax melted, and he plunged to his death in the Mediterranean. Don't know quite what the message is there, but anyway. And there is a painting of it in this museum, apparently, by Bruegel, I think. You can see the painting online, but what it is actually there is this boat on the water, and there is this farmer tending to his fields, and there is this tiny little splash, which is Icarus splashing into the water. So, I'll read it and you can follow it if you want, but that's part of the resources there. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there must always be children who didn't especially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot, the old masters, that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it wasn't an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to go, get to, and sailed calmly on. Thank you. So, about suffering, they were never wrong. How it takes place when someone else is eating, opening a window, or just walking dully along. It's just part of life, I think, is what I understand from that there. And then later on, I don't fully understand the middle bit, but so towards the end is the variety of responses that we can have, that we have. Other things are important in our lives, like the ploughman. We've got to get the field ploughed, we've got to get the food in or whatever. Yeah, that's happened, but you know, we're bound up in our own concerns. Likewise with the expensive, delicate ship. To me that suggests, I don't know, but suggests how we can distract ourselves with so many even peripheral things, you know, I remember one teacher talking about how we're distracting ourselves to death, how we just, you know, sort of find important all these other aspects of life, But it can be a way, as a way of distracting ourselves from, you know, the harsh reality that we're born, we're here, and we die. And while we're here, we do the best that we can with the lot that we've been given. So, yeah, I don't know. So there are various other reactions to suffering as well. Say we can deny it, we can pretend it's not happening. I'm okay, no, I'm fine. No, really, honestly, I'm fine. And, you know, and come on, pull your socks up, you'll be okay, just get on with life. You know, there are many different reactions that we can have that serve some kind of purpose for us, but maybe they're not, maybe they might be necessary at the time, but maybe they're not the most skillful. And maybe if they come from a place of not really wanting to accept that suffering happens, that difficulties, problems arise in life, and that we muddle through basically the best that we can without the resources that we have, you know, it can be a way of distracting ourselves. So if we do start to acknowledge that it exists, what difference might it make? For starters, we said, as suggested earlier with Anne there, that our response to suffering can make it better or worse. If we deny it, if we try to pretend it's not happening, we might be able to get by for a while, but eventually it might come back and bite us in the bum, basically, that eventually it can overwhelm us. Or maybe we can just get through, but we're having to sort of cut off part of our experience in a sense, in that way. Or we can become overwhelmed if we're not careful. And again, it's good to learn skills to recognize, to be open to our own capacities and our own possibilities of things that we can do that are more helpful. One thing that we can do is to recognize is that it's not permanent or unchanging, which isn't to, you know, I don't want to disrespect, you know, there are great sufferings and griefs and traumas that happen in people's lives, but they're never always the same. There are moments when there are greater or lesser, and some of them do indeed pass, even from our memories at times. And just remembering that at times when we're feeling overwhelmed by our own suffering or by the suffering of someone we care about or general societal suffering problems, you know, things change. It's the nature of things to change. They always are, whether we want to, or, you know, whether we want them to or not. Just knowing that can help to give us a sense of balance again. And there may be something that we can do in the here and now. There may be some practical things that we can do, if not to remove it completely, but to help make it better. We can sit with a friend. We can sit with our own pain for a while and allow it to be and see what evolves. There may be something practical we can do. We can make a cup of tea for someone. We can get their shopping, do whatever. You know, there are things that we can do. And if we can, then let's do them. And if we can't, then just accept actually that there are some things that we cannot change. You know, we're not God. We're not, you know, omnipotent. There are some things that are beyond our control. And also thinking, well, you know, again, coming on to another poem, actually, this is one that Sue first pointed out to me, which I absolutely love, very grateful for. You know, sometimes, you know, there are, if we've been through a period ourselves of difficult times, of difficulty, we can recognise that actually we have gained something as a person. We have gained something from that experience. You know, maybe it leads to a clarity of vision. You know, we can see things more clearly. What's important? Friends of mine who have been refugees, have told me that they recognize now, they know what's important in life, then they're not distracted by the peripheral stuff. It can certainly bring us humility, which is a good positive quality, I think, to have in our minds. So, you know, that we're just like everybody else, we're the same. We don't know what's around the corner. And it can also increase our ability to empathize and to be with others and to feel connection with others. You know, when my dad died all those years ago, I recognized that up until then, although I thought I'd been sympathetic or empathetic to friends who had suffered loss, I hadn't touched the surface, you know. I hadn't really recognized, like you were saying, Sue, you know, if you can see the extent of somebody else's suffering, if you've been through something similarly yourself as well, you can kind of really, you know, that there is that much greater feeling of closeness. And we can, you know, be more, if we go through difficulties, and if it's something, a mistake that we have made, as sometimes we do, then we can be motivated to try and avoid that kind of thing in the future. And to help anybody else who may be going through something similar themselves, to avoid it in the future. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, that we should go out looking for suffering or for difficulties or problems, but when they arise, or perhaps in the moment it's not so easy, but, you know, in retrospect, we can look back and see that there was maybe some benefit to be had. And that also goes, I guess, you know, it strikes me with the whole COVID business, you know, lots of people saying, certainly towards the beginning, not so much now, that, you know, that maybe with all this shutting down and closing down again, we can reconnect with what is actually important in life. And there certainly was a very great movement towards in that direction when it first started, and it, you know, in many cases has continued, that feeling, reconnecting again with community, with kindness, of appreciation, all of those things, you know, can come out of something which is essentially difficult and problematic. So I'll read this poem, I think, and then go straight into a meditation on compassion, and then we'll have discussion after that, if that's okay, yeah? And by all means, you can treat the poem as a kind of sort of lead into the meditation if you want. It's called Kindness, and it's by a poet called Naomi Shihab Nye, an Arab American lady. Okay. So, before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Sometimes it feels like that, doesn't it? Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It's I you've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So let's do the meditation. This is a meditation on compassion, and it's from that Fearless Heart book. I've adapted it slightly. And this is maybe the only thing we can do in a situation where compassion is needed. But it's not nothing, it's definitely something. So get into a comfortable posture again. And then settle the mind by becoming aware of your breathing. So think of someone for whom you feel a great amount of uncomplicated affection. It's not necessary to have a visual image of this person. Simply think or feel the presence of this person as tangibly as possible. Maybe the person you had in the first meditation, maybe somebody different, doesn't matter. Notice how you feel in your heart as you think of this person. Can you think of a time when this person was going through a difficult experience? Or perhaps they're in the middle of one now. Try to imagine what it feels like for them. Notice what feelings arise in you as you think of this person suffering. You may feel an aching sensation in your heart, or a sense of unease in your gut, or the urge to reach out and help. If no specific feelings or sensations arise in you, stay with the breath. Whatever thoughts or feelings arise, just observe and stay with them. As you try to stay with this person in their suffering. then, keeping in mind the suffering of this person, silently offer the following phrases, or ones like them. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you find safety and peace. Or if there are phrases that more naturally follow, use those. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you find safety and peace. So repeat this practice for a little while, continuing to attend to your breath and keeping the person in mind. Every now and then, refresh the thought of the person and contemplate his or her suffering and needs. Then silently offer the phrases as before. In this way, repeat the practice for a while. Say 5 minutes. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you find safety and peace. then, as we bring the meditation to a close, imagine that as you breathe out, a warm light emerges from the center of your heart and touches the person that you have in mind. As it does so, imagine that this eases the person's suffering, bringing peace and tranquility. Then, with a heartfelt wish that this person be free of this suffering, once again, silently repeat the phrases. May you be free of suffering. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you find safety and peace. Maybe again, just check in with your own heart, mind. See how you feel. If you feel replenished by this activity or somehow depleted. If you feel depleted, then wish for yourself the energy, the courage that's needed for such a practice. You can have the same wishes. May I be free from suffering. May I be free from fear and anxiety. May I find safety and peace. And when you're ready, end the meditation. Okay, everyone all right? So the meditations also are written up and in among the resources if you want to continue at any time. Again, that's a very popular standard kind of meditation based on, I think, the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. And it can develop from there, which we'll be looking at again later in the weekend in the course. So we've got 20 minutes now. So I open it up to you, really. I've said probably more than enough. So if anybody wants to comment or question or wants to anything at all, Anne, yeah?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. You're probably going to deal with this later in the weekend, but one of my huge difficulties is when you're dealing with somebody who's very, very difficult. I mean, it could be a political figure that you're thinking of, or somebody in your personal, I mean, really difficult. People have got wrong. I don't have any difficulty at all generating the compassion. I see that they're in a bad place. They can't help it. I see that. I've got that. It's okay. Using skillful means, particularly if it's in your personal life, skillful means to deal with them. I struggle with it. I struggle quite purposefully. I'm getting somewhere, but, you know, anything that you can say about that will be very helpful, please.
Okay, yeah. We will be going on to those we find more difficult. That's the stretch. That's where we grow. And I can't remember what I planned to say then, but just for now, I used to have this work colleague who drove me absolutely bonkers. Well, she didn't drive me bonkers, of course. That's how I described it. I found it very, very difficult to cope with her way of being. And she was my only work colleague, you know. And I, again, like you say, I could see where she was coming from. I could understand, but my own reaction was still, you know, my own buttons were still being pressed. And when I was on retreat down in Guy House, actually, so another retreat centre, so probably, you know, there we go. And the teacher that I was talking to the teacher there about this, and she said, you don't have to like them. They don't have to be your best friend or even a friend. And that was a revelation for me, because that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing. What I understood her to be saying, and what I had been doing, was, as far as possible, not acting out of dislike or irritation or all the other things that came up for me with her, with this colleague. And to try and always remind myself that this is how she was, and not everybody, you know, all those techniques that we use, not everybody found her like that. Although in my defense, many people did, but not get into that thing of, oh, she's always like that, blah, 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 you know, to hold back from that seeking, you know, sort of other people backing me up that it really was her problem and not mine, kind of thing. And just accept, you know, the situation, see the situation clearly. I think, you know, it's that lucidity that was in that earlier quote. You know, part of the situation is that she has these ways of being which can be difficult to get along with. Another part of the situation is that I find it difficult to get on with those. And another part of the situation is that we have to work together. So, and that's all. Another part of the situation wasn't that we had to become friends. We just had to be able to rub along and work and be, I would try to be as kind as possible, to at least avoid being unkind. Does that help?
I do get that. And I use sort of thank you for the lesson quite often, because that's quite a nice little phrase.
Yeah.
But it's really about protecting, and not just yourself. I mean, in this case, I'm talking about somebody around the family, and it's just protecting my grandchildren, actually, from a particular person emotionally. And it's very complicated. Mm. Anyway, thank you very much.
It was a good question, and, you know, good response. Life is messy and complicated, isn't it? You know, I would be doing you all a disservice if I tried to suggest that at the end of this meditation, you go away, put these things into practice, and you would never have any problems with people again. Of course it's not. You know, there are people, and you do what you can in the situation, and you acknowledge what you can't do. But what you can do is, you know, the same in terms of your grandchildren, is just continue to give them your love.
Of course, yes.
Your support and as and when they need, because that can never go astray, can it, really? That will always help them. Avril, you wanted to say something there.
Yeah, thank you. In Buddhist terms, I could be wrong, do they not say whoever's really troubling you, pressing your buttons, etc., and we all have that, that they are your biggest teacher? I could never absolutely get that. A mirror image of there's something in them that's mirroring something in you. But yeah, I'm not sure entirely.
Yeah, no.
I do get that, and that's the thank you for the lesson thing. I do get that, I really do, because I spent a long time working with this, and on intellectual. No, and actually on a practical level, I get it too. It's purely the skillful means of being able to protect. This protective thing comes in. I'm perhaps not explaining it awfully well, and I don't want to go into the situation on a personal level, obviously.
No.
But anyway, I just threw it out there. Thank you.
Mm. Yeah, but as for the the other person being your greatest teacher, it's that in terms of psychology, there is that thing, isn't there, that often what we see clearly in other people is what we don't particularly want to see in ourselves. I don't know that that's always true, and I don't know, I could be just being particularly blind, but at the same time, I mean, from the Buddhist perspective, you know, one of the qualities that we have to develop is patience. And how on earth are we going to develop patience if everybody's always nice to us all the time? We're not, are we? So maybe just on that level, they can be our teacher. I don't know. I don't know what.
I don't want to dominate this, but can I just? Sorry, Monica, but just one last thing. I think it's not when it's to do with me. In a certain way, I get my head around it and use the British side, you know, whatever. Mm. It's when it affects other people, and particularly, you know, that's, I find that much, much harder find skillful means, because you want to jump in there and do something. And of course, maybe I've just got to let that go. Anyway, I don't want to dominate this, but thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Monica, did you have something to add?
Actually, you know, taking on from what has already been said, you know, when I've worked a lot with victims of violence and people who are in abusive relationships and all that, and one always advises them to move out of that situation rather than remain in that kind of a toxicity, so and deal with that violence, you know. So in the context of what we've been saying now, in the context of, I may have some amount of how do I like, even having compassion, you know, it's not like your example of a work colleague, but here you're in the same house as that person. And how do you actually, is it all right for you to just walk out? And how do you deal with that? You know, I mean, that kind of suffering and.
Yes, that things are, problems aren't always as trivial as a work colleague, are they? I think you're absolutely right. If I mean, from your experience, you would know that of course, protect yourself, be safe, if you can, and if that's advice you can give to somebody to protect themselves and be safe. Of course, it's not, you know, seeing clearly means seeing also, you know, sort of taking time to see what the options are, what the dangers are, I guess, and what the real options are in terms of your own behavior or in terms of supporting other people. I guess the only thing that I can think of, and others please join in and add, you've probably got more experience, but I suppose the only thing I can think of is try not to go, it's where the compassion comes in, is trying not to go down the path of hating the perpetrator. You know, recognizing the faults and the action that needs to be taken, but try as best you can not to go down that road of hating that person, because actually, if you can get yourself safely away, acknowledging the harm that may have been done, that's been done, holding hatred in your heart actually only makes it worse for yourself. So it's also out of compassion for yourself, I think. I don't know, what does anyone else think? Is
that makes sense.
Does that make sense to you, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Does that fit with your experience?
Yeah, I mean, you always tell a person to move on. and you know, have a closure. So you also kind of advise that.
And recognizing that, you know, there are causes and conditions that have come together for that situation to have arisen, for those two people to have come together, for those, you know, the individual behaviors, they haven't come out of nowhere. You know, they've, you know, trying to bring some level of understanding. But of course, you know, there, if there is a practical action that needs to be taken for safety, long-term or short-term, then that must be taken.
Sometimes forgiveness is very difficult.
This
is a challenge.
Absolutely. Forgiveness, I mean, there's one of the articles that I've put in the resources is about a couple of incredible stories of forgiveness. I couldn't even begin to comment, really, because, you know, to me, that's an extraordinarily open-hearted, wise, but open-hearted and difficult thing to do. But if you can ever possibly get to that, then how wonderful. That's that state.
Just on the forgiveness thing, there's a quote I rather like. I think it's Jack Kornfield. And he says, forgiveness is primarily for our own sake, so that we do not bear the burden of resentment. It does not mean we allow the injustice to happen again. I really like that.
That's that two sides of the wisdom, isn't it? Mm. Thank you, Anne. That's really helpful.
That's really wonderful. That's really wonderful.
Anyone else have a comment about? Yeah, Anne, Avril, sorry.
well, just sort of simplistically, if someone's at risk, yes, surely they need to have compassion for themselves. But it's not perhaps that easy when they've been abused or harmed. In some way to have compassion for themselves so they can grow and heal. Yeah, it depends on circumstances, but yes, as Monica's saying, they have to put closure and leave. But yeah, for them to grow, they need to have this compassion and practice and work on that, perhaps.
And maybe, you know, if you haven't had a, you know, if there has been an abusive past and you haven't had that stability or that caring, that nurturing when you've needed it, I was immediately thinking, you know, that's when if others can give compassion, you know, then you can, if you can receive compassion from other people, then that's maybe a first step. But sometimes, you know, in those people, you know, people who have been very damaged, it can be even very difficult to receive, to accept compassion, can't it? It's hard. It's hard. And just small steps and small, you know, small tools. And, you know, that again, the coming back to the breath, you know, is maybe something that can be done. Or being, you know, just being nice to yourself, going out for a walk, going into nature, getting a dog, you know, dogs love you generally, don't they? I don't know, you know, we do what we can, don't we? We find what works for us, I guess, in these situations.
Yes, I was just thinking about what a lot of people were talking about and thinking back again. And, you know, in the context of being vulnerable in an abusive situation, whatever that might be, you know, sometimes it's too big an option to leave and get out. But actually the way that you can be alongside somebody is to help them develop that compassion for themselves, which in turn, you know, gives them that moment one morning when they wake up and say, you know, I think I'm good enough to walk away from this now. And that can take a really long time. I mean, obviously it depends on the situation, and sometimes you know, that's just not possible. But to enable somebody to find that compassion for themselves so that they can then make that choice to leave a situation is an incredible thing to happen, because the person has been in control when they've never been in control. And I think sometimes as the person in the supportive role there, you can get carried away with, you know, the danger is you get carried away by the indignant anger and wanting to remove the person immediately from the situation of danger. And that might work, but it might, from my experience, it often doesn't, because the initial work of the person finding compassion for themselves hasn't happened. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does.
You know, it's all that empowerment work, really. Mm.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Very helpful. I thought it was something else then, but I've forgotten it. Drat. Something that what you said triggered. Yeah, I suppose also another aspect of what that made me think of when you were talking, another aspect of sort of refining our compassion is letting go of our own agendas of this is what should happen, this is what this person should do, and being prepared to wait, as you were saying, until they're ready, until they're strong enough, if we can, you know.
It's one of the hardest things, I feel, from my experience, is to bracket all your own bias, you know. I mean, oh, the times I've sat there, you know, wanting to physically go round to a house or whatever, or, you know that anger on behalf of somebody. The hardest thing is to bracket that and, you know, absolutely recognise that's all about me and not about this person. Really, really hard, because we all get triggered, don't we? Yes, when somebody introduced me to, like, put your stuff, Sue, in brackets and find a place for it in the brain, I found that very helpful.
Thank you.
It didn't go away, but it just contained it in two little things, like a bracket.
Yes. It acknowledges, it's not denying your own reactions, which would be uncompassionate to yourself. It's acknowledging them, but saying, but they're not, they don't have a place here right now. Maybe later you'd want to unbracket them and have a look at them.
Yes. I was thinking of you, Anne, you know, brackets might help, or whatever image works for you. Yes.
Absolutely. Okay, so I make that tea break time again. So another 20-minute break.